We've already mentioned in Chapter 14 and elsewhere the name of Shi Huangdi, who consolidated an empire much smaller indeed than the present limits of China, but still very great and populous, spreading from the valleys of the Huanghe and the Yangtze. He became king of Qin in 246 BC and emperor in 220 BC, and he reigned until 210. And during this third of a century, he effected much the same work of consolidation that Augustus Caesar carried out in Rome two centuries later. At his death, there was dynastic trouble for 4 years, and then in 206 BC, a fresh dynasty, the Han, established itself and ruled for 229 years. The opening quarter century of the Christian era was troubled by a usurper. Then, what's called the later Han dynasty recovered power and ruled for another century and a half, until China, in the time of the Antonines, was so devastated by an 11-year pestilence as to fall into disorder. This same pestilence, we may note, also helped to produce a century of confusion in the Western world. But altogether, until this happened, for more than 400 years, central China was generally at peace, and on the whole, well-governed, a cycle of strength and prosperity unparalleled by anything in the experience of the Western world. Only the first of the Han monarchs continued the policy of Shi Huangdi against the literati. His successor restored the classics, for the old separatist tradition was broken, and in the uniformity of learning throughout the empire lay, he saw, the cement of Chinese unity. While the Roman world was still blind to the need of any universal mental organization, the Han emperors were setting up a uniform system of education and of literary degrees throughout China that has maintained the intellectual solidarity of that great and always expanding country into modern times. The bureaucrats of Rome were of the most miscellaneous origins and traditions. The bureaucrats of China were, and are still, made in the same mould, all members of one tradition. Since the Han days, China has experienced great vicissitudes of political fortune, but they've never changed her fundamental character. She's been divided, but she's always recovered her unity. She's been conquered, but she's always absorbed and assimilated her conquerors. But from our present point of view, the most important consequences of this consolidation of China under Shi Huangdi and the Hans was in its reaction upon the unsettled tribes of the northern and western border of China. Throughout the disordered centuries before the time of Shi Huangdi, the Xiongnu, or Huns, had occupied Mongolia and large portions of northern China, and had raided freely into China and interfered freely in Chinese politics. The new power and organization of the Chinese civilization began to change this state of affairs for good and all. We've already, in our first account of Chinese beginnings, noted the existence of these Huns. It's necessary now to explain briefly who and what they were. Even in using this word, Hun, as a general equivalent for the Xiongnu, we step onto controversial ground. In our accounts of the development of the Western world, we've had occasion to name the Scythians, and to explain the difficulty of distinguishing clearly between Cimmerians, Sarmatians, Medes, Persians, Parthians, Goths, and other more or less nomadic, more or less Aryan peoples, who drifted to and fro in a great arc between the Danube and Central Asia. While sections of the Aryans were moving south and acquiring a developing civilization, these other Aryan peoples were developing mobility and nomadism. They were learning the life of the tent, the wagon, and the herd. They were learning also to use milk as a food basis, and were probably becoming less agricultural, less disposed to take even snatch crops than they had been. Their development was being aided by a slow change in climate that was replacing the swamps and forests and parklands of South Russia and Central Asia by steppes, by wide grazing lands, that is, which favoured a healthy, unsettled life, and necessitated an annual movement between summer and winter pasture. These peoples had only the lowest political forms. They split up, they mingled together. The various races had identical social habits, and so it is that the difficulty, the impossibility, of sharp distinctions between them arises. Now, the case of the Mongolian races to the north and northwest of the Chinese civilization is very parallel. There can be little doubt that the Huingnu, the Huns, and the later people called the Mongols were all very much the same people, and that the Turks and Tartars presently branched off from this same drifting Mongolian population. Kalmucks and Buryats are later developments of the same strain. Here we shall favour the use of the word Hun as a sort of general term for these tribes, just as we have been free and wide in our use of Scythian in the West. The consolidation of China was a very serious matter for these Hunnish peoples. Hitherto their overflow of population had gone adventuring southward into the disorders of divided China as water goes into a sponge. Now they found a wall built against them, a firm government and disciplined armies cutting them off from the grass plains. And though the wall held them back, it didn't hold back the Chinese. They were increasing and multiplying through these centuries of peace, and as they increased and multiplied, they spread steadily with house and plough wherever the soil permitted. They spread westward into Tibet and northward and northwesterly, perhaps to the edge of the Gobi Desert. They spread into the homes and pasturing and hunting grounds of the Hunnish nomads, exactly as the white people of the United States spread westward into the hunting grounds of the Red Indians. And in spite of raid and massacre, they were just as invincible because they had the pressure of numbers and a strong avenging government behind them. Even without the latter support, the cultivating civilization of China has enormous powers of permeation and extension. It has spread slowly and continuously for 3,000 years. It's spreading in Manchuria and Siberia today. It roots deeply where it spreads. Partly the Huns were civilized and assimilated by the Chinese. The more northerly Huns were checked, and their superabundant energies were turned westward. The southern Huns were merged into the imperial population. If the reader will examine the map of Central Asia, he'll see that very great mountain barriers separate the southern, western, and eastern peoples of Asia. But he should be wary of forming his ideas from a map upon Mercator's projection, which enormously exaggerates the areas and distances of northern Asia and Siberia. He'll find that from the central mountain masses, three great mountain systems radiate eastward. The Himalayas, going southeastward, south of Tibet, the Kuen-Lun eastward, north of Tibet, and the Tian Shan northeastward to join the Altai Mountains. Further to the north is the Great Plain, still steadily thawing and drying. Between the Tian Shan and the Kuen-Lun is an area, the Tarim Basin, roughly eastern Turkestan, of rivers that never reach the sea, but end in swamps and intermittent lakes. This basin was much more fertile in the past than it is now. The mountain barrier to the west of this Tarim Basin is high, but not forbidding. There are many practicable routes downward into western Turkestan, and it's possible to travel either along the northern foothills of the Kuen-Lun or by the Tarim Valley westward from China to Kashgar, where the roads converge, and so over the mountains to Kokand, Samarkand, and Bukhara. Here, then, is the natural meeting place in history of Aryan and Mongolian, here or round by the sea. We've already noted how Alexander the Great came to one side of the barrier in 329 BC. High among the mountains of Turkestan, a lake preserves his name. Indeed, so living is the tradition of his great raid that almost any stone ruin in Central Asia is still ascribed to Iskander.